This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Justin Schmidt grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania where not much happens. So what passed for fun was watching little critters like biting ants, stinging wasps, and other insects that terrified people many times their size. And for Justin, this pastime became much more than a way to fend off boredom. His youthful adventures, including accepting dares to sit on ant mounds and knock down hornets' nests, ultimately led to a career as an entomologist, and his exploits only got more daring. His hands-on research and eponymous pain scale have earned him the title the King of Sting. Justin Schmidt is a research entomologist at Southwestern Biological Institute in Arizona, and he joins me now. Justin, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me more about your interest in bugs growing up in Pennsylvania.
Well, it's just one of those things that you don't really think about. You know, you're a kid and you're just living your life, having fun, skipping rocks across ponds. And, oh, by the way, there's that pretty little butterfly there. Oh, wow, look at this. Even more spectacular little wasp. It's sitting on the golden rod and it's just doing its thing. And, hey, this is cool. Life never gets better.
But people tend to be afraid of the butterflies, not so much, but anything with a stinger, even kids are afraid of those, right? And apparently you weren't.
Well, I think I was just too dumb and oblivious to actually notice the difference. But I did have a few encounters, as you mentioned in the intro, that most of them were out of foolishness. But I'm still here and still alive, so no long-term damage, I think.
Well, still here, but, you know, the fact is that after those encounters, a lot of people say, oh, now I've smartened up, stay away from the ones with stingers. But you didn't.
Well, each one is different, and so you got to, ants, you know, they bite and they're a little bit scary, but they can't fly. And then you get bumblebees. Oh, no, they're much more interesting. And then even more interesting than bumblebees are bald-faced hornets, so always an adventure, always another hill to climb and another valley to cross, and never-ending enjoyment of just watching and participating in life along with these insects.
Well, let's talk about some of the fascinating things that you have learned since this has become your profession. When you think about it, most of us like to avoid things with stingers, and I think that's because adaptively we've associated pain with damage. But you say that's not always the case when it comes to what insects do, right?
Exactly. Insects are the greatest of bluffers in some respects. You get stung by, say, a honeybee, and it really hurts. But as you notice, there's been a beekeeping community going on for thousands of years. And if it was really doing any damage, we wouldn't have any beekeepers. They would have, we hope, have gotten smart enough to say, hey, this is a bad business. You don't see people rearing cobras, or at least not very many people are rearing cobras. And, you know, they're truly dangerous. And so it's kind of a bluff thing in saying, on the bee's part, hey, look, I'm really scary, I'm really dangerous, and I can really hurt you. Oh, by the way, I don't really do any damage. but they don't tell you that.
Is all stinging behavior on the part of insects purely defensive, or do they do this as is it ever predatory?
Actually, a lot of them, the majority of stinging insects, use their venom for catching dinner. In other words, if you're a parasitic wasp and you have this caterpillar that's 100 times bigger than you, you have to inactivate it before you can lay eggs in it. And so often they'll sting it and it paralyzes it, sometimes just for a short period of time, you know, just minutes, sometimes longer, allows them to lay their eggs in them, and then the young can eat the caterpillar. In this case, if you grab this same wasp, chances are it won't even try to sting you. And if it does, it won't really hurt.
I'm assuming it's the same mechanism that they use for defense and offense, that what they bite and inject venom, they use that for prey, and they use that to tell you to back off. But not so for insects, not always.
But with insects, we often see this, for example, something like a tarantula hawk, which is a very large gunmetal blue-black wasp, often with orange wings. They will paralyze a tarantula, they sting it and paralyze it, but it turns out the material that paralyzes the tarantula is totally inactive on us. Hmm. And presumably the tarantula isn't feeling any pain, because if it were, its metabolism would gear up and then it would quickly die just due to exhaustion. which would be bad for the tarantula hawk's young who are eating the tarantula. Anyway, that aside, they independently have components that hurt us, and they are not toxic.
So in other words, when they're in defensive mode, they're injecting something that is different than when they're in offensive mode. They have two different substances.
I think what they're doing is injecting the same cocktail. It's just that depends on who it's going into. If it's going into a tarantula,
I get it.
The active component or components, we're not sure just how many. I suspect it's mainly just one, goes and paralyzes the tarantula. And actually, quite quickly, in fact. And when they sting us, a different component, actually also quite quickly, gives us excruciating pain.
Wow. So they've this is amazing that they've essentially adapted to these various kinds of DNA, the thing that can hurt me, the defensive thing. We need to really scare them with a lot of pain. This other one, we need to be adjusted to this particular prey that we want to feed to our kids. That's pretty fine-tuned adaptation. And the evolution of the stinger itself is fascinating stuff. Tell us about your theories about how that may have evolved.
Yeah, that's quite fascinating that most people don't really think about, where did this stinger come from? But it turns out the ancestors of stinging insects were something we call sawflies. Now, they're not really a fly. They're a primitive hymenopteran, which is the group that includes ants, wasps, and bees. And what they did was they had an ovipositor, that is an egg-laying tube, and they would use it to kind of saw into hard things like stems of bushes and trees and plants and lay their eggs in a protected place. So then that evolved through a series of, wood is awfully hard and not very nutritious. How about if we stick eggs into another animal like a juicy caterpillar or a beetle larva or something of this sort of white grub? And if you do this, then you, again, can lay the egg in it. And in the process, you modify your ovipositor so that it has some paralytic things that inactivate the prey. Now, the final step, then, is where you actually have evolved mostly defensive value. The egg no longer comes out of the end of the ovipositor, the egg-laying tube. Now it comes out at the base. And that allowed, then, the evolution of venom, which goes through the stinger. It's now called a stinger, and that's the active part. And the interesting thing there is that only the females, of course, sting.
So it raises another question about this evolution and very specialized forms of stinging, and that is why some stinging insects actually, can only do that trick once, that it kills them, and other insects, that's not the case.
Yeah, that's the fascinating conundrum that Charles Darwin, the author of The Origin of the Species and famous expedition on the Beagle ship, and he always had this problem of, if you're trying to pass your family line down to the future, how do you do that if you die and commit suicide by stinging and your stinger pulls out? That's kind of a problem. You can't have too many offspring if your stinger and you're eviscerated and your guts are all hanging out. Sorry for that description, but that's literally what happens. And, how can you do this? And Charles was a pretty bright chap. This was long before we knew about genetics and biochemistry wasn't really a field at that point. And he sort of said, let's see, scratching his head. He thought, if I'm related to my sisters and brothers and my cousins and aunts and uncles, then if they survive because I gave up my life, then they will pass along the family genes. He didn't know there were genes, family lineage. And I'm part of that lineage. So indirectly, I am benefiting the future generations of my family by losing my life and sparing all of my close relatives. And the thing that in order for this to work, you have to be relatively expendable. And, that's kind of a harsh way of looking at it.
Well, it is because it doesn't explain exactly why, since other insects can do this and not lose their viscera, why one insect would develop this suicidal tendency when, in fact, I've got cousins who can do this without giving up the whole show.
But exactly. And the solution is that it turns out a bee is fairly big and it's fairly slow at injecting its venom in you. So you have this problem. You have to stick around on your host, say like the beekeeper or you or me or, you know, whoever it is that they're being stung, for a minute or so in order to get all of your venom in. Well, most things will kind of notice, ouch, this hurts. Get this bloody thing off of me. And so they knock them off. And so a yellow jacket or a bumblebee will get knocked away before it can give you a really totally thorough dose of venom. But the honeybee gets around this problem by, you knock the honeybee off, aha, problem solved. Wrong. The stinger is still there. You don't see it. It's just a little tiny thing. And especially if you're something like a bear or a raccoon or something that has a lot of fur on you, you won't really see it and you won't know it. So then over the next minute, it puts rather than 10%, you know, a little bit of their venom into you, it puts the whole shebang in. So therefore, it's worth sacrificing your life because you get a full dose and do a much better job of defending your mom.
Revenge.
After all, mom is the only one that counts. Yeah. She's the only one that reproduces. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't. You just feed mom's babies, your brothers and sisters, and feed her. Wow. But you can't directly reproduce yourself.
This is great. This is revenge from the grave. I love this.
Exactly.
Right. This is great. Hey, listen, I want to talk about something else, too. Again, fascinated me that you did an experiment with two closely related ant species, right? And found out that there are very different ways in which they behave. Talk about the twig ant. And is it the bullhorn acacia ant?
Exactly. Yeah, I was in Costa Rica. I was studying Africanized bees, the thing we often call the notorious killer bees. This was before they got into the U.S. And I ran into the bullhorn acacia ants. Acacia, bullhorn acacias are just small little scrubby things, bushes, small trees. And they have these big fat spines on them. And they're loaded, absolutely loaded with thousands of little skinny, scrawny, emaciated looking ants. But don't let that deceive you. These guys can hurt. And they roar out there, the fierce warriors, if they've ever seen them. And they crawl all over you and sting you. And they smart, you know, the dinky little guys that are about an eighth of an inch long. And you say maybe 3/16, something like that. They're pretty small. And you say, how come these things hurt so much? Then on the other hand, they have a sister species that are called the graceful twig ant. And that one lives in small colonies, has nothing to defend except itself, and it lives in twigs. You actually see them in Florida. That's where I ran into them. And they're almost half an inch long. They're much bigger. But they're timid. If you've ever been in an area where you've seen lizards on a branch, you want to get a closer look at it. Oops, the lizard scooted around behind the branch. You can't see it. So you go around the other side, and it scoots back around. Well, the same thing is what this slender twig ant does. It kind of scoots around and hides. And you say, this is rather different behavior. But it's like a brother or sister to the other species. So I said, well, what happens if it does sting? Will it hurt? And will it hurt a whole lot more? My prediction was that, well, since it's so timid and has nothing to defend and such, it probably, A, will be hard to get it to sting me. And B, it probably won't hurt much. And it turned out that was exactly the case.
And what's interesting is that what is defending the other ant, right, the bullhorn acacia ant, is actually defending the tree. There's a symbiotic relationship that if that's the right word for it, that it's developed with the tree. So it's really keeping animals and other things away from the tree as much as the ant colony, right?
Exactly. In fact, It's a wonderful thing for the plant. Plant really thrives because of this. It not only keeps the cows that would eat its leaves away, but in addition to that, they actually will go down on the ground and clip the vegetation, which is trying to compete for the sunlight and the water and the nutrients. So they'll actually prune and culture the host tree. Now, this is, like you say, a symbiosis that it's not all just, well, I'm going to do this out of my goodness of my heart for the bush. The plant is giving the ant everything it needs. All it's asking in return is saying, keep me alive and I'll keep you alive.
This is amazing stuff, which is why I suppose someone like you and perhaps the rest of us should pay attention to bugs. There's a lot we can learn about our relationship and interdependence on the natural world. I'm talking with entomologist Justin Schmidt on the state of things. By the way, there's a pain scale named for you that actually made its way into the movies. So you're kind of famous. Let's listen to this.
Okay, who's next?
Parapanera clavata.
I know, bullet ants, right? Number one on the Schmidt Pain Index.
Hey guys, remember me from the bedroom?
The Schmidt Pain Index, that's your index. How did you, tell us about the Pain Index. That's
exactly.
from one of those Marvel superhero movies. But anyway.
Called Ant-Man.
Ant-Man.
Yeah, I was basically in graduate school as a struggling, starving graduate student, which most of us go through one phase or another in our career. And I had this problem. I had a hypothesis that the evolution of sociality occurred because the social insects had a way of defending themselves, and that is that they were able to sting, and that the sting had two defensive values that helped them evolve sociality. One was, of course, they could do damage to you, but the other and more important one, perhaps, was that they hurt. So then we had this problem that we can measure damage. There's lots of tests, biochemical and molecular and that sort of thing for measuring damage. That's not so hard to do. How do you measure pain? Oops, we got a problem here. It turns out, you know, if you say, well, a bumblebee hurts, and oh, yeah, by the way, a honeybee hurts, and oh, yes, that wasp over there hurts too, and oh, yeah, that fire ant, yeah, it hurts too. You can't really compare them. And the idea was that we had to be able to compare and say that those species that had less to lose would therefore have less powerful venom, especially in terms of pain. And in order to do so, we'd have to measure it. And the problem is you can't stick an electrode or an EEG or something like that into your skin and measure the pain. There's no actual way to get numbers. So I said, well, we can make numbers some other way. Let's assign numbers on the basis of a honeybee is 2, something that's a whole lot less than a honeybee will be a 1, and something that's a whole lot more than a honeybee will be a 3. And so it's a self-analysis system, just like you go into the McGill pain scale for people that have chronic pain and they self-assess, you know, what their pain level is. You do this with stinging insects.
Yeah, but you were the self on which these insects were tested and came up with the pain, right? You had them sting you, and you were the one who said, oh, yeah, that's a 4.
Well, exactly. It wasn't just me. I have kind of a large number of buddies. And I'm pretty sneaky, you know, I'll go up to somebody, another entomologist, get stung by some wasp or ant, and I'll kind of saunter up and ask them, well, how does this hurt? And they say, oh, it really hurts. And I say, well, how does it hurt compared to, say, a honeybee? You know, just giving a leading kind of prompt here and there. And say, oh, well, it didn't hurt as much as a honeybee. And I say, well, was it substantially less than a honeybee? Oh, yeah. In other words, I'd far rather be stung by this. So then that would be a 1. And they say, in another case, they'll come up with a big wasp down in the Amazon tropics that they get stung by and say, how does this feel? Whoa! Oh, my goodness, this thing was awful. This is terrible, terrible, terrible. Ah! And they go on and say, well, how is this compared to honeybee? Oh, honeybee's nothing. It's child's play. So this will clearly be a 3. And so we made 4 points on the scale. And each one you can kind of imagine. It's kind of an informal scale in that like 10 times a 1 is a 2. In other words, if you get stung by fire ants, which you have in North Carolina, 1 fire ant would be a 1. 10 fire ant stings would be a 2. And of course, nobody gets 1 fire ant sting. So most of the time people say, these things are awful, which yes, I agree they are. Yeah. I don't like fire ants any more than the other person.
Yeah, well, so, I tell you what, I know you said that I can just imagine, and that's exactly where I'm going to leave it. I will try to just imagine, and I will thank you for your scale and your work. Justin Schmidt, a research entomologist at Southwestern Biological Institute in Arizona. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
If you want to learn a whole lot more about stinging insects and other bugs, you can head to the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh this Saturday, October 20th, for Bug Fest. You will not be stung unless, like Justin, you want to be. Just ahead, a new historical fiction book explores one woman's role in turning the Vanderbilts into Asheville's most famous family. Stay tuned.